Chapter 28, News from Sikkim. The way in which I spent the first day of the new year was far from being typical of how I spent the whole month. But although January was a busy time for me, it also happens to be one of those times my recollection of which is decidedly patchy. In itself, this is not surprising. What is surprising is that I should have no memory whatever of the very event which, of all the events of the month, might reasonably be expected to have made the strongest impression on me, and of which, therefore, I might be thought to have the clearest and most vivid recollection. This notable event was the memorial meeting held for Lal Bahadur Shastri, the Prime Minister of India, who had died suddenly a few days earlier, and which, according to my diary, I attended with Terry. The entry for Friday the 21st reads, in part, "Reached Albert Hall soon after seven and took our seats on the platform. Speeches by Prime Minister Harold Wilson, Lord Mountbatten, Selwyn Lloyd, Lord Sorensen and Jeremy Thorpe. Lord Attlee, Kingsley Martin, Dame Sybil Thorndike, Arnold Toynbee, etc., also present. All over by 8:30. Whether I spoke to anyone or anyone spoke to me, either before or after the meeting, I do not know, but I must have surveyed this gathering of the nation's great and good with considerable interest, and have been more than a little pleased, perhaps, to find myself, probably thanks to friends in the Indian High Commission, occupying a seat on the platform as sole representative of Buddhism. But if I have no memory of the Albert Hall meeting, I have a distinct recollection of what Terry and I did straight afterwards. Then round to Clare's, my diary continues, in its usual laconic fashion. Fitted my cloak. Left at 9:15. The Clare in question was the elegant, well-groomed Clare Sampson. Though she was no longer secretary of the Sangha Association, we were still in touch, as she had offered to make me a winter cloak to replace the light summer one that had been stitched for me shortly after my arrival in England by Upasika Jnananda, the elderly Russian nun who had been a disciple of the notorious Chao Kung, alias Trebitscht Lincoln, and who lived alone in a flat not far from the Vihara on a stipend from the Sangha Trust. Clare, being a much less experienced needlewoman than the old Upasika, my winter cloak had been a long time in the making, and it was only now, more than halfway through January, that Terry and I found ourselves visiting her in her basement flat in Victoria for my fitting. The cloak was of a thick woollen material, dark brown in colour, and so voluminous that it hung down round me in a multiplicity of folds. It was also very heavy and very hot, so that when it was at last finished, I wore it only when the weather was exceptionally cold, or used it as a blanket. In its very different way, my brown woollen cloak proved to be no less inconvenient a garment than Satatissa's yellow cotton tube. Victoria was the scene of another visit that month. This time I paid it on my own, and not to a tiny basement flat, but to a spacious apartment in the vicinity of Westminster Cathedral. The apartment had been rented from a relative of the Queen, by Paldan Thondup Nangyal, the Maharaja of Sikkim, who was paying a short visit to London with his American second wife, the former Hope Cook, and their small son. I had known the Maharaja since the early 50s, when he was still Crown Prince, and had several times been his guest in Gangtok, the principality's village capital, when I went there to lecture on the Dharma. Indeed, I believe I was his guest in Gangtok and delivered lectures there not long before my departure for England. Politically, Sikkim, population about 200,000, was a protectorate of India. Constitutionally, it was a diarchy, in that some powers were vested in the Maharaja, who exercised them through his Diwan, actually an Indian appointee, and some in the elected representatives of the people. There were a number of political parties, as well as a representative of the Government of India, known as the political officer, who, like his British predecessors, was the real power in the land. The situation was further complicated by the fact that the ruling family and the land-owning aristocracy were of Tibetan Buddhist stock, while the rest of the population was mainly Hindu and mainly of Nepalese immigrant origin. I was in the uncomfortable position of being on friendly terms both with the Maharaja and with Kazi Lendup Dorje, the Maharaja's main political opponent, who lived in Kalimpong and who, with his formidable European wife, was committed to the overthrow of the Namgyel dynasty and the establishment of full parliamentary democracy in Sikkim. The Karzini, as she was universally known, was the Maharaja's bête noire on account of the campaign she was conducting against him in the correspondence columns of the English-language Calcutta dailies, and whenever we met, he would be sure to complain bitterly to me about her latest attacks. The present occasion was no exception. After we had discussed the state of British Buddhism and the current political situation in Sikkim, the Maharaja proceeded to launch into his customary diatribe against the Karzini, a diatribe that his painful stutter did not make it easy for him to deliver. Since he and the Karzini were both Buddhists, he was president of the Mahabodhi Society, she a personal disciple of mine, I had always sought to pour oil, the oil of the Dharma, on these very troubled waters, and if I could not bring the two of them together, at least persuade them to moderate their hostility. Hitherto I had been unsuccessful, and in London, as far as the Maharaja was concerned, unsuccessful I continued to be. Paldun Thondup Namgyel was not the only Sikkimese friend who was in town that month. One afternoon I received a visit from diminutive, quietly spoken Sonam Topge, who was a nephew of Kazi Lendup Dorje, a member of the political officer's staff and a disciple of Dujom Rinpoche, one of my own Vajrayana gurus, and who had been the means of my meeting more than one eminent Tibetan Lama. Sonam's visit was not without a purpose. As I already knew, the political officer had placed his services at the disposal of the Dalai Lama, and he had come to ask me if I would help correct the English of a book His Holiness was writing on Tibetan Buddhism. Naturally, I agreed, though Sonam was unable to say how long it would be before the first draft of the book was ready. The rest of our time together was spent exchanging news of common friends, talking about the Dalai Lama and the Karmapa, and discussing at considerable length the important Buddhist doctrine of the so-called two truths, namely, the relative truth and the absolute truth, or to translate the Indian terms more literally, the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. More than my meeting with the Maharaja, my contact with Sonam Topge brought with it memories of my life in the foothills of the eastern Himalayas, with their views of the distant snow peaks, their colourful local people, and their no less colourful festivals and processions. As we talked, I could almost hear the deep, rumbling sound of the Tibetan trumpets, almost smell the acrid perfume of the juniper incense. From the foothills of the eastern Himalayas to the suburbs of South London is a far cry, and it did not take long for my memories of the one to be obliterated by my far older memories of the other, when, a few days after Sonam's visit, Terry and I drove down to Southfields to see my father and Auntie Florrie, as I still thought of her. I had seen my mother a few weeks earlier, when she told me of the death of my Auntie Jessie, who had been a kindly presence in my early childhood, and now it was time for me to see my father. Of my actual meeting with him and Florrie, I remember only that he showed Terry some photographs of me as a child. But I have a vivid recollection of the journey to Southfields. From central London, we drove down across Westminster Bridge to Kennington, and from Kennington down through Oval, Stockwell, Clapham, Balham, and Tooting Bec to Tooting Broadway, where we turned right into Garrett Lane. Garrett Lane, formerly known as Defoe Road, after the author of Robinson Crusoe, who once lived there, took us to Earlsfield, where we turned left at the station, made our way through the side streets, and so arrived at my father and Auntie Florrie's door. Balham, Tooting Bec, and the Broadway were the heart of working-class South London. They also happened to be the scene of the first 18 years of my life, and as we drove through them, I looked out of the window of the little bus with more than just idle curiosity. Much had changed. Balham Hill was no longer dominated by the giant green dome of the Hippodrome. Traffic had increased tenfold, and there were no swaying, clanging trams rattling along. The biggest change, however, was in the population. Two-thirds of the people thronging the streets of Balham and Tooting Bec were Asian, and some, the women especially, wore traditional dress. In Upper Tooting High Street, many of the names above the shops were Punjabi, Gujarati, and Bengali names, while the windows of the shops themselves, more often than not, displayed either crimson, emerald green, and mustard yellow saris, or pyramids of Indian sweetmeats covered with silver foil. One could almost have fancied oneself in Bombay. The South London of 1966, it seemed, was an altogether more crowded, lively, and colourful place than the South London I had known in the 30s and 40s. Towards the end of the month, Terry and I saw several films, only one of which I remember at all clearly. This was the famous screen version of Henry V, with Laurence Olivier in the title role, which, according to my diary, I enjoyed very much, though I thought the sets a little crude. Terry had now more or less recovered from the depression into which the circumstances of his send-off had plunged him, and which had lasted for several days, and we spent much of such time as we were able to spend together listening to music and discussing the books we were reading, which in my case included D.T. Suzuki's The Zen Doctrine of No Mind, and in Terry's The Heart of Man by Eric Fromm. We also visited Bristol, where I addressed the members of the university's International Society on Buddhism and Western Civilization, and where, taking advantage of the opportunity, we looked round the cathedral, including the particularly impressive Norman Chapter House, and saw the Church of St. Mary Redcliffe, the fairest parish in England according to Elizabeth I, with its poignant associations with Chatterton, the marvellous boy. On the way back to London, we stopped first at Bath, where we saw the Abbey, then at Oxford, where, having spent an hour at the Ashmolean, we called on Trungpa Rinpoche, who was happy to accept my invitation to conduct a few meditation courses at Biddulph.